This week on the Eldritch Lorecast.
What is your approach to magic item shops?
Boy, I can't wait to get to the dungeon where it's safe.
The Seeker's Guide to Enchanting Emporiums, soon to hit Kickstarter.
Ghostfire's Black Flag Adventures.
First adventure for people who want to see what I think an Aurora adventure should begin like.
D&D streaming service.
Ad supported.
They're like creating a content block in the way that like basic cable creates content blocks.
There's also a sneak release onto Drive-Thru RPG.
It's all that anyone's been talking about on Reddit.
Is there anything on the WotC release schedule for next year before the 2024 Player's Handbook?
I can't talk about certain things NDA-wise.
I don't know, Sean. Cool kids throw caution to the wind and talk about
That's
it
true.
Even if there is an NDA.
All that and more right now.
Hello everybody and welcome to this week's episode of the Eldritch Lorecast, episode 110. That's right, Unbroken. I'm pretty proud of that record so far. My name's Ben Byrne and I'm joined by James Hake, Dale Kingsmill, Sean Merwin. And Sean, I've got to ask, what is your approach to magic item shops in your D&D or general fantasy campaign?
When I first started DMing, they were in every town, no matter how small, because magic items were da bomb. Everybody wanted them. They were awesome. They made people happy. And then I realized what magic items could do to a campaign, especially in first edition D&D. And they became a little more scarce, a little more exotic, a little more deadly. The joke in my home group was, boy, I can't wait to get to the dungeon where it's safe after trying to go to the magic shop where all sorts of horrible fates befell the party. They would go to auctions where magic items were being auctioned. And of course, demons would attack because, hey, if there are powerful magic items, demons are going to want to get their brimstone little hands on them. So, yeah, that's where I am. And I'm looking forward to, say, a book that would cover all this for us, but I'm sure that would never happen.
Yeah, you know, who would ever make that sort of thing? Dale Kingsmill, what about yourself? How have you approached magic item shops or magic item emporiums, you might say?
Emporiums, you might say. I, broadly speaking, I don't tend to include magic item shops. I could get away with saying it's like, oh, it's because it doesn't match the vibes of my world, the vague and evocative vibes. But actually the biggest reason is that I don't trust what it does to the in-game economy. but the closest I've gotten to having magic shops in my game is that in one game I had a city that was built kind of like on the border between this realm and kind of the Feywild. It's like on a place where the planes all layer on top of each other. And so every time the party went into that city, I would roll a d20. And if it was a natural 20, they never got a natural 20. But if it was a natural 20, they would slip into sort of a side pocket dimension where a lot of sort of magic user types, witchy types, would make use of this sort of slip in space in order to have a black magic black market. And ooh. It was the place where you could buy magic stuff, but it was much more in the vein of like, I don't know, it was based on like a short story my sister wrote one time, which was, you know, you can go in and you can change your mind literally, but also metaphorically. And so it's like by buying this other mind, you can just change your opinion about a thing. And, you know, you can, I don't know, sell one of your two left feet in order to be better at dancing. That kind of it was a little bit like the beginning of Stardust. In terms of magic item shop.
The more I've gone down this rabbit hole, because I agree with the both of you so far in what you've said in terms of like, there's an axe beneath the Green Dragon's lair in Lost Mines of Phandelver. That's just a +1 axe. That's all it is. But as soon as my players got that axe, the barbarian suddenly had access to a magic weapon, which conquered all resistances and immunities. And I was like, and it's a +1. Oh, he's hitting on like 7+. He almost never misses anymore. Okay, magic items they're a deft touch in 5e, I feel. But the more that I've gone down the rabbit hole of magic items through the years, through my campaigns, at times where I've gone like, oh, I really need something here to break up the dark fantasy, so to speak. Everybody's feeling really depressed at the moment. Let's go for a shopping trip. Let's just have a fey creature show up in the middle of the wilderness and just be like, what are you guys doing here? This is my forest. Yeah, I've got all these weird
that
items.
Guy from
is that
the start
weird?
Of Aladdin.
Yeah, basically that. James Hake, what about yourself? What's your approach to magic item shops?
I like offbeat magic item shops. I respect and have used often the standard trade in gold, get magic items sort of, you know, standard style shop. But I like it when they're a little bit more, I don't know, when it's not just gold for a thing. Magic items feel like they're too mythical for that to work out. And if I want a shop that is, you know, just sort of commercial, then I try and think of them in terms of something just a little bit more unusual than that. Like in my current campaign, I have a shop called the Arcane Exchange that really digs at the purpose of why player characters want to buy magic items. It's because the magic items they got through the act of adventure don't suit what they want to do with their character. And so the Arcane Exchange, I start by going out of game saying, hey, players, what magic items do you like really, really want? Do you have a wish list? Fourth edition D&D actually literally had a magic item wish list for people to give the DM. Like that was encouraged. You're like, because not all my players love optimizing, but some of them really do. I've got sort of a multi-class rogue barbarian that really has his eye on a couple of magic items that would suit his build well. And so I'm like, Ben, do you want... Not you, Ben, my player, Ben. Do you want, what kind of magic item do you want in the shop? And he'll tell me. And I will sort of fill the shop shelves with magic items I think are cool and magic items that my players think are cool. And then they can trade in magic items they've gotten through gameplay for that at a rate of like rarity equals rarity or four of the lower tier equals one up, right? Like you could trade a very rare for a very rare. Or four rares for a very rare. And that I like the vibe that gives. It's like these people aren't dealing in magic items because they think it's an economically viable strategy. The people who operate that shop are fellow adventurers themselves. And they're kind of like academically cataloging all of the magic items that exist in the world. They have a sort of ulterior motive other than keep the shop going. And then there's my very first campaign's sort of standout shopkeeper, which was an NPC called Blackbird. This sort of fey demonic entity that would often be found outside the entrances to dungeons, kind of as if it knew the players were going to be there. And within their bag, Blackbird had all of these sort of kind of offbeat, weird magic items that didn't seem like they would be particularly useful, like a rope that can be commanded to sort of snap rigid like a fireman's pole or something like that. And yet all of those magic items that Blackbird had in their inventory would be somehow extremely useful within that dungeon. They would be like the key to a puzzle if the players were willing to give up something extremely valuable and non-monetary, often in a sort of fey bargain, you know, infernal pact bit of weirdness, like a treasured memory or something like that.
We've got Mr. Fizzer in chat saying, I tend to use witches / hags as magic item shops, so any gold cost is abstracted into personal dramatic cost.
Yeah.
I do love it.
But there, you know, there are also players that love trading gold for stuff, so.
Witches don't care about capitalism.
I had an idea recently that I'm sure other people have had as well, which is the idea of a magic item shop, kind of like the magic item shop from Rick and Morty, where everything's cursed and Rick comes in and he just like sees through the ruse immediately, that the devil is running the shop. But basically the idea that you don't buy in gold, you make a contract with the devil, and it's basically a way to get quests for magic items. So it's not an instant like, give me your soul, ha ha ha, now I've got you locked in a pact, but it's like, well, I need this dude to die, or I need this dude not to die, or my patron, you know, maybe the shop owner is a warlock rather than the devil themselves. And it's like, my patron requires this to be collected. So if you bring me that back, then I'll, you know, you can purchase one of these items.
A warlock who's got a tithe to hell that he has to pay. I need to collect at least 10 souls every X number of years. How do I do it? By selling magic items.
Pure volume.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Witches don't care about capitalism. Warlocks do.
But I loved the idea of that Blackbird character that you mentioned, James. There's something very, which I think is on brand for you, Legends of Zelda about that, the idea that like at the start of the dungeon, there's this character that's like, you might need this, trust me, but you have to give me something for it. If folk wanted to include Blackbird in their D&D campaign, in their own D&D campaign, would that be possible?
You know, indeed there is. Because Ghostfire Gaming is coming out with a book called The Seeker's Guide to Enchanting Emporiums, soon to hit Kickstarter. And I was actually really, really chuffed to bring back Blackbird from kind of the dark corners of my memory and kind of revamp his backstory, create something fun, something that, that players would enjoy inserting into their own campaigns, or DMs would enjoy, rather. And it's just delightful to see that character illustrated with full sort of fey and fiendish glory, along with a lot of other really cool shopkeepers.
I'm not a regular shopkeeper. I'm a cool shopkeeper.
All right, Mom, just let's do it. I mean, we're going to do a couple of deep dives. This is jumping into our first news segment, which is Ghostfire Gaming's new Kickstarter starting on November 21st, I want to say, is the launch date. But I've just thrown a link into the chat for people who want to go follow the campaign. But give us maybe, the real elevator pitch, because we're going to talk about this in future weeks. But what is this book fundamentally providing?
Enchanting Emporiums is a book of magic item shops, not just magic items. So there are plenty of new magic items unique to the individual shops there that are kind of based around the idea of giving you locations and characters that you want to recur in your campaign over and over again, sort of the characters that your players will love to return to. I think of them in terms of Gilmore from Critical Role or Pumat Soul from Critical Role's second campaign. Characters, shopkeepers that are characters in their own right that you may go on quests for, that you may, you know, simply meet once and buy a magic item from, or whose shops you want to explore, because just going through that shop is an adventure of itself. Sort of the titular shop, which is the one ran by the Seeker. Also, you know, the one that Runesmith made for us, Seeker's Guide to Twisted Taverns, that Seeker, is really this kind of planes-faring pet kennel that goes, you know, it is an adventure going through that place. And there are plenty of others. There's ones for Grimhollow. There's ones that really dig into Aurora. And I've been working on this book for like well over a year now, working with a lot of really cool designers on it. And I want to just like tell every single thing, but I can't remember what we've put on the Kickstarter page. So I don't want to like spoil a big reveal that we're going to do sometime in the next, you know, month or two. So with all that said, fantastic shops. Shopkeepers who you will want to return to again and again, and a boatload of new magic items. That's Enchanting Emporiums.
Yeah, what I love about it, the ones that I've seen so far, is that they are adventure locations, right? They are kind of exactly what we've been talking about. The idea is that it's more than just go in and exchange gold for magic item. You can do that if you want to, but there is more to discover there. They could be recurring characters that show up a couple of times. And I also really love the strong theming around them. One of my favorite shops, particularly because I've seen the artwork for it, is Bramble. Bramble's the shopkeeper. Is it the Grove? The Hedgerow? Something
like
that it's called.
Yes, the Hedgerow.
The Hedgerow, yes.
Have we announced who did that one?
I suppose we could announce it now.
We could announce it now. We got Ginny D to create a fey plant shop called the Hedgerow with her own sort of unique pixie shopkeeper.
It's the artwork's really cool, and I haven't read it, but from what I can tell from looking at the really amazing artwork, is it's like this shopkeeper is cultivating the plants to grow into armor and equipment. And so far, I've seen like a cuirass that look. I think I'm saying that word correctly, or a chest cuirass. Plate that kind of. Thank you. Looks like it's grown out of vines, and shoes that look like they grow onto your feet, and a shield that's a giant leaf.
A helmet made out of a watermelon shell.
Woo!
It's a gourd for your gourd. A melon for your melon.
There you go. I will say this sounds like it shares a lot of strengths with Twisted Taverns as a book. You know, the strong thing was theming, and the more you come back, the more you can kind of uncover these sort of adventure elements within the store that you know, becomes part of the story.
Dale, that's and actually really bring- like that, that's a really astute observation, because this didn't start as a seeker's guide book. This started as just, you know, Enchanting Emporiums, no subtitle. But as it developed, we're like, okay, we not only need the seeker in here, but we need to like, we need to pair these. These are kind of a dyad together.
And with all of the different kinds that you're going to see, it will fit into your world no matter what your world is like. You will find one that matches the theme. Dark fantasy, we got your Grim Hollow one. Survival, we have your Aurora one. And you know, all of it coming together will, you'll find something you love in it as a game master, regardless of the type of game that you like to run.
I got to be a small part of it, which I'm really chuffed about, working on one of the traveling traders that you might come across in your adventures. I worked on a Grim Hollow one. The one thing I'll say is that there are some Easter eggs in there for Grim Hollow fans who pay close attention to particularly the campaign guide. So look forward to that if you're going to follow along. I'll throw the link one more time into the chat because I feel like we're doing it well this week. Go team. The Seeker's Guide to Enchanting Emporiums, the page is up on Kickstarter if you want to go follow it. And in the meanwhile, speaking of Ghostfire Gaming, there's actually more Ghostfire news this week. I think actually this is technically last week Ghostfire news. Ghostfire's Black Flag Adventures, the adventures that were converted to or designed specifically for Tales of the Valiant or using the Black Flag system from Kobold Press, are now up on DriveThruRPG. We have three of them available from Grim Hollow. We have the Penumbral Vestibule, which is the first chapter of the first episode of the first Fables adventure, Citadel of the Unseen Sun, now converted for Black
Love
Flag.
Love a good use of the word vestibule.
I had to look up what that meant the first time I read that. I'm not going to lie.
Oh, you should read Piranesi. You'll read the word vestibule so many times.
We've also got from Pirates of the Ethereal Expanse, The Treasure of Shipgrave Reef, which we actually did in a live play at PAX last year, 2022, at PAX Oz 2022. And we also have, and this is new, I haven't read this because I believe it's been freshly written, which Sean, I might ask you to speak to, which is Aurora, We All Fall Down, which is this the first adventure written for Aurora?
That is correct. It is the first adventure for people who want to see what I think an Aurora adventure should begin like. So it's there for you. We being Joe Rosso and I ran this at GameholeCon. We each ran a table twice. And so people got a chance to see not just the adventure, but the pre-generated characters built with our new Aurora-based character generation system that Scott Gray worked on with my help. So very excited to see it out there. And we released the first copy will be a using the Black Flag system, but we're also working on a version that just uses regular old fifth edition that I believe backers of our Kickstarter, Aurora Kickstarter, will receive free, but it's also available or will become available in 5e version soon and Black Flag version right now.
Sean, I just want to say that I'm really delighted that three adventures that you and I wrote are being in this big Kobold Press release, because you and I have got a lot of good history with Kobold Press. Those are wonderful people. And we just like probably haven't had much time to work with lately because of our involvement with Ghostfire and other folks.
Yeah, and it was great because I got to do this conversion, and I hadn't I'd read the Grim Hollow adventure because I ran it, but I hadn't read Treasure of Shipgrave Reef, and so I got a chance to read it and realize what an actually awesome adventure it is, and so you know, getting to work on it was my way into it, which I otherwise may not have been able to do. So it was a great opportunity for me to play around with the Kobold Press's new system, think about it in different terms, get some Ghostfire Gaming adventure out there for people to see, and yeah, super excited about it all.
Nice. Tales of the Valiant, we talked last week, so Black Flag have released their SRD that folks can use to basically run these adventures using. I'm just out of the loop on this. Do we know, have they released anything more official than their SRD in terms of a set of rules for running these adventures? Because this is part of a larger bundle from Black Flag. The Black Flag role-playing adventure pack is what it's called, which can be found on DriveThruRPG, which includes these three adventures plus adventures and content contributed from a whole host, an alliance of third-party publishers, if you will. But yeah, I was kind of surprised to see this up on DriveThruRPG myself.
Surprise!
I like that question mark at the end.
Well, when all the SRD kerfuffle was going down, I panicked. And I was like, oh my god, the D&D paradigm is over, we're all gonna die. And luckily that's not really true. I'm glad it all worked out. But I like emailed Wolfgang Bauer and was like, we gotta figure something out here, because in case this didn't work out, I either wanted to bring like Ghostfire and Kobold Press into a like formal alliance, or I needed an exit strategy or something with a company that was making its own system. And we were really, really keen on the idea of, you know, having a new sort of open source game that all the third party publishers could work with. And that, you know, that's a big ask, right? That's like creating a new universal standard. And whenever you create a new universal standard, all of a sudden there's just a new proprietary standard, right? Because getting people to agree to a universal standard is almost impossible. So in many ways, I'm glad that D&D as we know it is still around, and that it like a good deal was made at the end of the SRD crisis. But it's
just
cool
so you
to
know,
see
the
a
whole
bit
way
of that-
through that, I was playing Howard Shore's The Last Alliance in my head.
Well, I'm just glad that there's like a fragment of that alliance that still exists out there, right? That there's a sort of Ghostfire, Kobold Press unity here in this release. And I want to, I don't know, I maybe it's kind of idealistic, but I want to see more of that stuff. There's so many good designers and great ideas out there, and the audiences are so fragmented. It would be great if we had this sort of combined reach. I don't know. This isn't company, you know, this isn't an official statement or anything. I'm just being, wouldn't it be nice if we could all get along and the sun would always shine and rainbows were everywhere?
I mean, that's, you know, I was pontificating earlier in the year, probably 6 months ago or something, about having, you know, the similarities between Black Flag and 5e noted, but having almost like a universal language that, or a universal kind of, sub-language, I suppose, that like there are different flavors of. Even Sean, you mentioned the way that Aurora you know creates characters entirely uniquely by rather than having species or race traits, you just kind of freely pick the traits that your character might have, and your character might have claws and a lion's head and eagle wings, you know, and you kind of create this unique character that we ported across to Valakan clans as well, so that you could, you know, freely pick your traits in Valakar. Like that is systemization to me. That is a branch of this 5e thing that Black Flag is also a branch of that still marry together really, really well, which I think is cool, you know?
Yeah. And that was one of the challenges of making We All Fall Down into a Black Flag product was, this adventure, like the other two adventures, come with pre-generated characters that are specifically tied to the plot of the story. So with the other two, it was just a matter of changing the encounters, changing wording, rewriting the monsters to fit into the system that Black Flag is setting up. This, the pre-gens were a whole different ballgame because you had to use the classes. And so I had to explain in the adventure, this doesn't work like normal Black Flag because we don't have species. We don't have heritages like Black Flag does. But this isn't anything that's, you know, we're not breaking away from that for any reason other than Aurora breaks away from that totally to start with. So let us introduce you to this through these characters.
I'm going to throw a link. This is to We All Fall Down, the Aurora adventure, which you can grab for $4.99. But as mentioned, if you search Black Flag Role-Playing Adventure Pack, It's currently $69.99 and includes the three Ghostfire adventures plus a host of other content from other third-party publishers. So if you're looking for a little bit, you can grab one of them. Or if you're looking for a lot, you can grab... If you're looking to dive into Black Flag, you can grab the lot of them. I've got a quick question. I've been sitting on this question. This question's almost a year old, I think, to our email address, podcast@ghostfiregaming.com, which came from Robert, who was asking which Aurora realm is the best to start a new campaign in your opinion.
The best.
Robert, I hope you're listening.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope you've been a regular.
We hope you're he stopped listening 6 months ago because we never answered his question. We're in a Gift of the Magi situation now. So when I first conceived of these realms, I decided that the best realm for the starter adventure would be the Arctic frozen realm of Prazalar. And the world went through some iterations after initial design. So when it came time to now create a different starter adventure, I went with Galat, which is the desert realm, because I think it best encapsulates the need for community in Aurora. That is a highlight, or what I hope is a highlight of any Aurora campaign. You do not survive alone. In a normal adventuring campaign, you need your party. In an Aurora campaign, you need your community. Your party isn't even enough to help you survive. You need more. And that realm best illustrated that with the way that it's been described in the book. So I started there. And just to show how design is a weird thing, we were getting ready to outline this adventure on a trip home from Gamehole Con last year. Hmm. And as we were driving, we're like, which realm should we use? And we happened to have in the car with us Andrew Baczynski, who was the writer of the Galat realm. So we're like, well, maybe we could do this, we could do that. And we're like, wait, you wrote Galat, right? Okay, we have 10 hours, go. And we started brainstorming, you know, what sorts of adventures would fit into this specific area. And I think it turned out very well. So thank you to Andrew for the brainstorming session while he was a hostage in a car.
Never stop designing.
Exactly.
Every minute of every day.
Always be car designing.
Car design's the best design. They're the best time to design.
That's ABCD.
That.
Sorry. I was
always be car designing.
Yeah, I was aiming for don't forget your ABCs. Always be car designing hyphenated, but then I realized I got very
don't forget
excited.
Your ABCDs. Always be car designing evermore.
Hey! Evermore forever. Mm-hmm. ABCDEFs.
God.
All right. Let's not do the whole album before. Also in the news this week, and we talked about this on the Lorecast, again, I want to say like 3 to 4 months ago, a D&D streaming service that is a fast streaming service, free access, I don't know what it stands for, but basically it's a free, thank you, and basically it's a 24-hour streaming service. My understanding is that it's just on for 24 hours, almost like a free-to-air style TV channel.
Like
it's
the Power not like, Rangers YouTube channel.
Sure, let's say that. So yeah, it's scheduled times for things rather than just like picking what you want to watch, which is interesting, but it's free and ad supported, so go get access to it. Anyway, that's launching. I think official launch is November 13th, the week of, the Monday. However, they are doing sort of a pre-launch earlier on November 8th. Sorry, I'm just looking through my notes here as I say this out. With a couple of new completely original shows going on there, as well as some more legacy style media productions going on there. All D&D themed, all D&D, all the time. If you want D&D in your eyeballs 24/7, this is the streaming service for you. with the new shows. They've released trailers for each of these three new shows as well. James, have you seen these trailers? Which one jumps out to you the most?
I'm a big fan of the one that, what's it called? It's Faster, Purple Worm, Kill, Kill. I really like that one. I like the sort of deep cut, raunchy 60s cinema reference that it is to Faster, Pussycat, Kill, Kill.
Weird which is movie.
Just a weird movie.
But, oh, yeah. So,
but it's a fun reference. I like it. And it just seems fun. It's cool to see. Who was it that's on that? It's not just Matt Lillard. It's like Justice Armin is on it, right? I'm not crazy, right?
A bunch of people are going to be on
there. There's a ton of people on there. Deborah Ann Woll is on there. Listen, I think we're talking about underrated people in the like celebrity level of D&D creation. Deborah Ann Woll is like at the top. She's unbelievable. She's got such effortless like improv immediacy and charm. I'm kind of sad that the stream or edited thing that she did a couple of years ago, I can hardly remember it now. It had this very sort of quirky, damn it, it's slipping through my fingers. There's been so much streaming over the past couple of years. I can't even remember what it was.
If you're,
you had this big high production value show that just, went nowhere. Yeah. No one watched it, I'm assuming, because streaming is a fool's market or something.
we say while talking about a newly launched stream, well, not.
Right. I mean, that's my worry, it's like Wizards tried to do a basically 24-hour weekly schedule with all of these shows, Trapped in the Birdcage, Rivals of Waterdeep, so much stuff. And I don't know, I'm pretty sure most of it is completely forgotten by this point, unless you were a huge mega fan of it.
The other thing that concerns me in a similar way is, I see some similarities in the choices they're making and the sort of late stage Geek and Sundry choices, in that there's kind of an emphasis, and I'm talking about Geek and Sundry, the YouTube channel, not so much the Twitch stream, although there was some overlap, but that emphasis on, look at the celebrities we've pulled,
sure,
which is fine and can be great. Tabletop was great for a really long time. Mm-hmm. Tabletop. As in the show on Geek and Sundry. But but at a certain point, I think you can lose sight of what makes it enjoyable to watch. Because people aren't tuning in just to see the face of their favorite celebrity. People are tuning in to see a good thing. It's impossible to say yet what the programming will be like. But I worry that they're going to lose sight of the entertainment value. I think it's really big and important that they've got, I think it's a big pull to get like high rollers and to be putting Rivals of Waterdeep on there, because I think those are the things that have established audiences, sure, and those established audiences are going to make or break this.
Well, it's not just the celebrities, and there are celebrities on this, and there are celebrities on this.
Yeah, like there are D&D celebrities, and then there are celebrities.
Like there's on Faster, Purple Worm, Kill, Kill, you've got people like Lou Wilson and Abria Iyengar who are, throughout the live play scene in the RPG world, but they're not household names unless you're into RPGs. And then you've got Seth Green and Patton Oswalt and even Deborah Ann Woll, whose celebrity through their acting careers definitely extends beyond just the tabletop space. But it's also the production values on these are huge. Like, Faster, Purple Worm, Kill, Kill. The other new show, although I believe it's being adapted from a podcast, is Encounter Party, which is a live play that, from the trailer, definitely has a very dramatic sort of vibe to it as opposed to a more comedy-style D&D stream. But it is full set, multi-camera, high-resolution, zoom in, zoom out. This is not a Zoom-style stream that you get. And Heroes Feast being the cooking show based on the D&D book, also with guests, also on a full kitchen set that's not like somebody's kitchen in their house that they've sort of set up some cameras in. The production values on this are
huge. It's a Ready Steady Cook set.
That's what I thought. I thought Ready Steady Cook too.
Yes, and I think that one's the one that I'm most excited for, because I think that at a certain point you give people an activity to do and they're either good at it or they're bad at it and they're trying to follow instructions. I think that takes away a lot of the kind of top layer of trying to perform well and just makes it like something entertaining.
Sure. Gotcha.
Well, we can kind of see with this cooking show, especially how maybe the ultimate goal with this channel is to diversify D&D as a brand, right? It's not just a game. It's a lifestyle. It's a lifestyle brand, which, you know, we can feel whatever we want to about that. But it does mean that their revenue stream is essentially decoupled from just how many people are playing the game, which is probably a savvy business move for a company with this much industry control.
Well, you know, you say company, and that's what's interesting about this is this is being produced by E1, who were sold by Hasbro, to my understanding, earlier this year to Lionsgate, I think, the current owner.
Oh, God, more geeky century flashbacks.
Like, was this too far down the pipeline for them to pull the brakes on, or did they say, screw it, we'll do it anyway? Or, like, how did this survive that sale? Is Lionsgate now have some sort of licensing deal with Wizards of the Coast to use Dungeons and Dragons through E1 to produce this streaming service?
D&D's no stranger to licensing, right? I mean, you know, Larian Studios has no connection to Wizards of the Coast other than their licensed developer.
Yeah, but that's a straightforward kind of licensing deal, right? That's I can't think of his name off the top of my head. Is it Sven, the head of Larian, going to, you know, he made a whole video about it, but going to Wizards of the Coast and going, may I have license, please? And Wizards going, yes, okay. would Lionsgate have bought the license for this in the transaction from E1? In the transaction of E1 going from Hasbro to Lionsgate?
No, that's possibly a really good point.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't assume any of us have the answer.
I see
here,
how it would work from Wizards' perspective in terms of, you know, it presumably would be cheaper for someone else to be, you know, taking on those production costs for a risky venture. I don't quite see what Lionsgate's getting from it, but they make strange choices sometimes.
Well, what you're getting from it, dear listener, is Faster Purple Worm Kill Kill, which is going to be new episodes will be on Thursday and Saturday at 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific. Now, when it's worded like that, I assume that means that it's going to be at 9 p.m. Eastern and then it's going to be on again at 9 p.m. Pacific, which slightly confuses me. Then for a streaming service in particular, then Encounter Party is going to air new episodes 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific Tuesday and Friday, and Heroes Feast is going to air new episodes 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific Monday and Wednesday. I'm not going to catch any of those. If I see these shows, it's definitely going to be on YouTube, like after the fact, right? Like, are any of you three excited to sit down and like see what's on the D&D streaming channel?
They're like creating a content block in the way that like basic cable creates content blocks, right? Like it's not syndication, but it's, you know, they're syndicating all of these shows back into rotation. Someone's going to have to manage that. The top level of this stuff is way more interesting to me than any of the individual like pieces. So I'll probably catch it on YouTube, just like you, Ben. I don't really care to sit down and watch anything live at 9 p.m. if I'm being honest. I would either rather be playing Baldur's Gate or, I don't know, like going out with my friends.
And then just the last little tidbit on this. I have good news for Taos from Mastering Dungeons, who just last week...
The other best podcast in all
the best D&D realms. Tabletop RPG podcast in all the realms, who just last week bemoaned the fact that they're bringing back so much from the D&D cartoon in terms of magic items in the new DMG, which we'll get to in a moment, etc. But they haven't brought back the cartoon yet. Well, Taos, have I got exciting news for you. You can tune in at some time and catch all the episodes of the D&D cartoon that are going to be streaming on D&D Adventures at some point. I hope it lines up with your schedule, as well as other live plays and things will be going on there as well, including Rivals of Waterdeep, High Rollers, Speaking of Dungeons and Dragons, there is also a sneak release onto DriveThru RPG, or was it on DM's Guild? Or it might have been both.
DM's Guild.
Chains of Asmodeus, written by James Olin and Adrian Chalkovsky. I'm going to assume their name is pronounced. Have just released this deep dive adventure into the realm of Asmodeus. Is that also a realm? I know it's a
Nessus
character.
Nessus is the ninth hell.
I'm fascinated by this for other reasons, but have any of you taken a look at this and seen what it's all about?
I haven't, but it's all that anyone's been talking about on Reddit. Everyone on Reddit has said, how come no one's talking about Chains of Asmodeus? But it's been like one after the other. So everyone's talking about it.
That's what got my attention.
You've got a question on the run sheet, Ben, that is, who is this guy? What is this thing? Why is this, like, it's, what is it? A passion project? I have the answer to this.
Oh, okay.
What is Chains of Asmodeus? Who is James Olin? Why does this exist? This is not the first such release that James Olin and his team have done on the DM's Guild. The first one was kind of timed with Baldur's Gate Descent into Avernus. And like many things related to that project, mistimed with Baldur's Gate 3, Minsk and Boo's Journal of Villainy, which is a similarly expansive and well-produced book that has significant ties to Baldur's Gate, because James Olin was deeply involved in the creation of the video games Baldur's Gate and Baldur's Gate 2. So this is a guy who clearly loves D&D and somehow, and I don't pretend to know this part, got a direct line with Wizards to kind of pseudo-officially create this supplement to D&D's sort of mythology. Also, Minsk and Boo's Journal of Villainy, freaking great product. Similarly, just like with this one on Reddit, like you said, Dale, everyone on Reddit was talking about it, but no one outside of Reddit knows anything about it. Totally flew under the radar. Definitely worth getting that one too.
Can I add a little piece to this mystery puzzle when it comes to Olin? Okay, because this is something that I'm fairly sure there was no NDA for and is several years old. So I, back when they released Odyssey of the Dragon Lords, which was kind of timed alongside the Theros release, so probably like 2020.
Right, that makes sense.
I did an interview with Jesse Sky, who also worked on that, and it was meant to be with Olin as well, but this is how my memory goes. This could be just false. We briefly chatted. Here we go. We briefly chatted, but he couldn't make the interview because he was interviewing with Wizards at the time for, I think, a video gamey branch attached to Wizards.
Yeah.
So I think that's when that was happening. And they published Odyssey of the Dragon Lords detached from association with Wizards. But I think that since then, the publishing company that they've got has developed an attachment with Wizards.
Well,
I wonder if it was that Texas studio. Anyway,
it was that Texas studio. I was going to say.
Yes. Okay.
So yes. This is so weird. Page.
I will add one more thing to this.
I'm going to Texas.
Good. This is why you watch the Lorecast, folks.
That's right. All this inside information, that's probably not true. If my memory serves.
It might be
serves,
from an old NDA.
It's true. If my memory serves, if you are an employee of Wizards of the Coast or an associated company with Wizards of the Coast, you cannot make money off the DM's Guild. So if you put something onto the DM's Guild, it has to be for charity. So some of the things that Mr. Olin has put up has been under Arcanum Worlds, which is his TTRPG publishing company. But once he began working for Archetype Entertainment, which is owned by Wizards of the Coast, then he could no longer make money off of it. So even though it says Wizards of the Coast on a Minsk and Boo's Journal and Chains of Asmodeus, I don't think Wizards of the Coast actually published it, but since it's being published by an employee, it needs to be under that umbrella and be done for charity.
This is the bizarre thing, kind of with the OGL, right? Because we had a similar situation several months back or last year that recurred a couple times. My nerd credentials are going to be called into question here because I can't recall his name, but the Eberron creator who Keith was, Baker. Thank you, who was creating content for Eberron that was official Eberron content, but Wizards were releasing their own Eberron books. And so it's kind of like unofficial official. And when everybody was saying stealth release of Wizards of the Coast book, Wizards of the Coast put out a book, I went and had a look at it. I'm like, hang on a second. This is not Wizards of the Coast. The fact that it says 5th edition spelled out in the little dash red thing on the cover, like, definitely looks third party. That is not Wizards of the Coast. And when I went to DM's Guild, it was like, okay, so it is Wizards of the Coast's, like, account on DM's Guild that have published. What is going on here? And then I went into this deep dive that you've all basically explained a different part of, which is that James Olin, who is essentially an employee of Wizards of the Coast through his video game company that has not produced a video game yet, as far as I can see, but he has produced this Chains of Asmodeus release and others that is on the DM's Guild that if you go purchase, all proceeds are going to charity, to Extra Life, in fact, if you want to go check it out. And it's just this bizarre situation of an Ouroboros or a tail wagging the dog in a weird way of just, like, the OGL just allows weird things to come from within Wizards or from some other part of the industry that is so confusing as to whether it's like, is this canon? Is this not? Like, imagine if just some Disney employee just put on Disney Plus, like, I don't know, Ki Adi Mundi, the series.
And Disney it was just works like, the other direction. Disney says, we own everything you make and it will never see the light of day.
Right. Sure. Sure. I mean, different legal things here going back and forth, but it's just a bizarre situation to me.
I feel very accomplished. There's something so satisfying about us all putting our little piece of the puzzle together.
Yeah. Somebody asked, is this the real Rod of Seven Parts? the long and short of it being, if you want to go and check out Chains of Asmodeus on DM's Guild, all proceeds go to Extra Life. Go check it out. I think it's $29.99, $39.99 off the top of my head. $29.99. Yeah, I have it right here.
Also worth mentioning, even though I haven't read Chains of Asmodeus, Odyssey of the Dragon Lords is huge, right? I have it over there somewhere. It's so big. You could use it to fend off burglars. Like, it's massive. They put so much into it. So I would be surprised if there's not a lot of great content in Chains of Asmodeus as well.
It's almost 300 pages of all sorts of great art, great coverage. Basically, think of it this way, is this is how it was described to me. If you were a really, really, really good DM and you were running Descent into Avernus and you made your whole world around that or all this content around that, this is what this book is. It is filling out all of the nine hells and an adventurer there and 50 plus new high level monsters, new infernal magic items, et cetera, et cetera. Stats for all the archdevils. Yeah. Mm.
Level and the art is gorgeous. I used the art in Odyssey of the Dragon Lords. I invented a game where I would just surprise my friends in group chats and say, choose your boyfriend, and show pictures of different characters from Odyssey of the Dragon Lords. And they had to pick which one they were going to date because they were all so hot. Anyway.
Your group chat sounds great, Dale.
another point of interest on this being that the adventure is levels 11 to 20. Which is fascinating, and people always asking for high level content. If you want a specifically high level content campaign, this sounds like it could be the one for you. Cool. Speaking of strange D&D things, I find it strange. Last year, I mean, this news almost escaped me, and this is kind of old news as well, because this old news comparatively, because this is coming out of GameholeCon. I'm not going to lie. I basically listened to Mastering Dungeons this week and I was like, hang on a second. I feel like I missed a whole section of what's going on. This time last year, we knew all the books that Wizards were releasing. We knew about Keys. We knew about Dragonlance before it was coming. We knew about Book of Many Things. We knew everything. There's a thumbnail with me and James in it with all the releases of this year kind of like laid out in a graphic.
It's and very Marvel stage six.
Yeah, exactly.
Phase six, and yet, not stage. Oh, I'm such a fake nerd.
This year, the information feels like it has just been dribbling out of Wizards of the Coast. I assume it's probably because they're doing a new edition next year, but everything is so vague and somewhat evocative as well, that it's like putting a puzzle together. And it's fascinating to me that everybody's talking about Chains of Asmodeus, which is what got my attention. Nobody's talking about the fact that Wizards kind of announced a whole bunch of stuff at GameholeCon about what's going to be in the new core books releasing in 2024, plus hinting at some adventures and other releases next year. Sean, you were on Mastering Dungeons last week, as you are every week. What jumped out at you as the most interesting thing?
I didn't go to this particular panel. I was standing outside of it when everyone was filing in, and it was very crowded. And I thought, what are they going to say? It turns out they said a lot. I'm excited that they felt comfortable enough to talk about the things that are going to be in the book, in the new books, in the Dungeon Master's Guide, Player's Handbook, Monster Manual. And could give away little bits of things. Just reassured me that we may not be hearing about it, but they have a plan and they are enacting a plan. And we may not see the plan before it happens, but as long as it rolls out well, I'm going to be okay with that.
Gotcha.
Yeah. I can't talk about certain things NDA wise that I'm very excited about. So maybe you should move along to another.
I don't know, Sean. Cool kids throw caution to the wind and talk about even if there is an NDA.
In 4 years, I will tell you all about it and then get it all
this
wrong.
This is what they mean when they talk about peer pressure.
I'm not under NDA, so anything that I have gleaned is public knowledge. I actually want to start in reverse because somebody just asked in the chat, is there anything on the WotC release schedule for next year before the 2024 Player's Handbook? 50th Anniversary Anthology, they talked about being as similar, an anthology similar to Radiant Citadel or Yawning Portal, taking a look back through the history of D&D with a romp around the multiverse. So that sounds like a book that could be like Q2 next year to me at a complete guess. So we've got an adventure book coming next year. But is that the same book? And this was pontificated upon on Mastering Dungeons as well. Is that the same book as the Vecna adventure? Is that the same book as the Red Wizards of Thay adventure? Is that the same book as the Venger adventure from the cartoon series? Because these are three things that they announced, and I think there's even a fourth villainous group from Tales Beyond the Witchlight that they hinted at coming back next year.
The action figures, yeah.
I don't know what that is. What?
Oh, no, so in the 80s or 90s, there was a bunch of action figures for D&D that didn't appear in any adventures. They weren't in the cartoon. There were guys like War Duke, who's like a burly Conan-esque guy who's got this big, you know, dread helmet on and red eyes, and a bunch of other dudes. They weren't in anything, but they were D&D characters that existed only as action figures, and they were the villainous like quartet that appeared in Wild Beyond the Witchlight. It took them like 40 years, but they were finally canonized in actual D&D product.
I love that so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, look up War Duke.
I think War Duke first got iteration.
I think War Duke got a miniature in third edition. So maybe he appeared in some obscure third edition thing. And they needed a mini for him. But look up War Duke on Google. he's very He-Man. And it makes sense that he first originated as a sort of He-Man-esque action figure. Did he appear in the cartoon? Well, shows how much I know about that cartoon, which is like basically nothing. So,
So based on those tidbits, which a lot of that they announced, you know, they hinted at the Red Wizards, the Venger thing, Vecna at the D&D Direct earlier in the year, which I feel like they had two of last year. And this year we had one back at the start of the year and then haven't sort of had any official videos since that weren't focused on a specific product release. In terms of the new, the bits of information coming out about the new core books, the DMG will include a campaign setting, which Taos and Sean, you both kind of pontificated might have been the surprise chapter that they were hinting about on Mastering Dungeons. New magic items that will fill rarity niches, including common items, which I want to see more common items that actually do stuff. That was my big problem with the common items in Xanathar's, I think they were in, is that they were just functionally cosmetics. It was like, yes, I describe my character as having glowing eyes now. It's like, great, cool. That's my opinion. Anyway,
I'm sorry.
On.
I'm looking up Warduke, and his cartoon appearance looks like it's like four different cartoon characters that have just been spliced together in a collage. It's incredible.
Taos Ads of Warduke did appear in an AD&D module, so he's extremely sporadic, but is basically a He-Man
a
character.
There's also a big banner above the picture that just says "Evildoer."
Oh, that Warduke, he's doing some evil.
He's doing that evil so hard.
He is an ill dude, let me tell ya. Every time he approaches a pack of witches, they're always telling ya this way wicked.
And also that they don't care about capitalism.
Not like those warlocks.
They haven't announced much in terms of changes to the monster manual. Yes, I'm still going to continue to kind of flounder through this. More high-level creatures plus quality of life improvements, bringing it up in line with more recent stat blocks, including the proficiency bonus in the stat block, for example. But we don't really know much about more changes that are coming to the monster manual. And then the player's handbook will have new spells, including something called Tasha's Bubbling Cauldron. Don't know what it does, but it sounds exciting. And then all books apparently do have mostly new art from new artists. And that got me pondering, do we think, or would it be fun to see a new art style? Because I feel like the art style of D&D has largely defined its editions as well. You know, art from 4E is pretty distinct from art from 5th edition. And art from, I haven't seen as much from 3rd or maybe 3rd and 4th blend together in my head a little bit, but I assume those two art styles are relatively distinct.
Yeah, well, it's also interesting because it seems to mirror in some ways the art style shifting in Magic the Gathering, which of course makes some sense because they're probably dipping into a lot of the same catalog of artists who we love to see. And, you know, I think MTG in a similar way has kind of evolved its predominant art style over time, although you still have sort of various artists who are mainstays who feel like sort of callbacks almost to previous art styles. I kind of would like to see a new art style, but I also love the current one. So It doesn't matter to me. I'll like it either way, but I am excited to get new art in general. I just think it's great. It's a lovely little sort of injection of life into it, and I love seeing artists get more work, you know.
Maybe I shouldn't say this. No, okay. I will say this. This doesn't spoil anything. We all know they're making new art. So D&D Adventurer, the UK-based magazine, right, is using a lot of art from 5th edition, and it's being put out at basically the same time as art pieces for these new books are coming in. And so every week we agonize and we're like, I haven't seen any of these new pieces of art. I'm not like, I don't have that clearance, but people will, the folks at Wizards will be like, man, it would be great to use this piece of art, but it can't appear in anything before it appears in the new core book. So they're just going to have to deal. It's like, I wanted to see that new art. Damn it, I wanted
That's
to see
problem.
That new art.
That's the problem I have with Ghostfire is sometimes being like, oh, that would make a great thumbnail, but that book's not out yet, so I can't use that. Or that would go great on the blog, you know. When art appears is a thing. I don't like the current art style for 5th edition.
Interesting. I took a while to come around on it. My big sticking point was the halflings.
Okay, why?
Because there is a clear choice. Yes, thank you, Sean. Good depiction. I think that someone somewhere along the way, this is pure speculation. None of this is real. This is just the story I've made up. I wonder whether someone along the way was like, well, we can emphasize the idea that they're small if we make it look like they're out of proportion, like you're seeing them from above, so the head is bigger than, and their feet are tiny, but they just look like they've got big heads and tiny feet and they look weird.
Yeah, okay. No, that's fair.
Stresses me out.
I just, look, the art for 5th edition is very beautiful to look at. It's very detailed. I think the artists are very talented, but it doesn't appear, and this is going to be kind of strange to describe, there's no teeth to it. Not that no monster is drawn with teeth, but absolutely 0% of that artwork is in any way whatsoever intimidating or frightening, even for monsters that are meant to be. It feels very much like PG-rated monster art. The old art of the Drider, I want to say from like 5th edition.
I think it's so telling that you're talking about the Monster Manual and I'm talking about the Player's Handbook. Anyway, go on.
Yeah, well, I guess that's more what I focus on. And you're right, that is telling. But there's old artwork of the Drider that I think is in 3rd edition that scared the hell out of me because it's a Drider kind of on the side of someone who is half wrapped up in web. Mm-hmm. And they're like, you can still see their eye kind of poking out and their arm is like wrapped up over themselves and they have this horrified expression on their face. And that as like a 7-year-old or however old I was at the time, maybe even 12, haunted me, right? But the current Drider artwork is just a dude standing there with a sword, you know, like going like, hey, what's up? I'm a Drider.
So and you're I feel upset like that Wizards isn't scarring children.
Basically, yes.
Okay. I just want to make that clear. Point. I think we now have the argument all wrapped up there.
More scarred children, please. Anyway, that's going to do it for this week's episode of the Eldritch Lorecast. If you want to help scar more children, like this podcast or share it around or give it stars wherever you're listening to it.
Give your 8-year-old Grim Hollow for Christmas.
There you go. Grim Hollow not rated for 8-year-olds. I've just discovered, if you're listening to this on Spotify, I've discovered a way to activate like comments on Spotify. So you can ask us questions there if you wish to. We didn't get any emails this week, unfortunately. Yeah, it's become a thing. It was phrased like ask a question of your audience. And I used the poll more often. I was like, oh, you know, this week we talked about the streaming service. Which show are you most excited to watch? And I'd create a poll. But there's also an open-ended version, which is like, what did you think of this episode? And I was like, that's kind of a lame question to ask. But then I realized you could just use that as a comment section. So I'm going to just turn that on every week and use it as a comment section. Hack so if you're listening system. On Spotify, mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Look, I'm going to be honest. I heard it on another podcast. It wasn't my idea, but it's still a good way to go. Otherwise, you can email podcast@ghostfiregaming.com. We do answer listener questions from time to time, but not this week, but maybe next week. Who knows? You'll have to listen to find out. We'll be back streaming on Twitch if you want to catch us there live. 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific on the Monday, 10 a.m. on Tuesday, Australia, Eastern Standard Time or Eastern Daylight Time. And other than that, I think I've done all the bits, the bobs, the rate us, the subscribes, the do all the stuff because it helps us get. Anyway, my name's Ben Ben Byrne here with Dale Kingsmill, James Hake, Sean Merwin, and we will be back next week with another episode of the Eldritch Lorecast.
We've got so welcome. Many different versions of Bubba-da-bars now.
And quickly welcome to Nerdotronic, who just said in the chat that they stumbled across the podcast. Welcome. Somebody else just said, Jason the Bruce, first time watching. Great show, loved it. Thank you, Jason.
Welcome.
Glad to have you aboard. And thanks to everybody else who was in the chat as well.
Thanks, Lorecats.
Thanks for Tails hanging out. Yeah. Thanks,
hey,
Lorecats.
Hey, the Lorecats.